Yes, it's Palm Sunday, and you have to ask a question about what kind of person would enter Jerusalem the way Jesus did. And if you know the story, he enters on a donkey, which had a funkier translation when I used the King James Bible as a kid. And he came up the hill. He comes up the hill in Jerusalem on a donkey, and he has his disciples staging, throwing their gowns down, staging an entry of an emperor into a Roman city after a victory of a military foe. So you have to think somebody who does this sort of thing on Palm Sunday has got some chutzpah. Now that's a Yiddish term for hubris and confidence. And so Jesus stages a mockery of the Roman Empire. It's like he wants to pick a fight on Palm Sunday. And we turned it into a cute little Sunday liturgical service. But it was very, very serious in the first century to do what Jesus did, to mock a Roman military victory by riding on a donkey and have a bunch of nobodies pretend like this is the king. This is the sort of person we have to get familiar with in the Gospels by asking the question that the people were asked on that video. Who do you think Jesus is? And I would like to entertain this question with you today. Who do you think he is? Some of you have sort of made up your mind who he is, and many of you have the right answers. But the answer to the question, who is Jesus, who is he for you, is a question that should penetrate and permeate everything about our life, everything about our public life, our private life, our family life, our church life, our political life, and when you cheer for Boston Red Sox against the Chicago Cubs, you should realize that King Jesus is for the underdogs. And I think you're with us now. So, and we're on the way up, we're hopeful for the Chicago Cubs. But I am never hopeful for the New York Yankees or the Green Bay Packers. Just so David didn't cover that part of reality for me. But that's very important to me. That if you wear a cheese head on your head, then I have problems with you. Love your enemies does not apply to that sort of thing. Who was Jesus? Who's the sort of person who says, I did not come to destroy the law and the prophets. I came to fulfill them. Who says things like this? What kind of person can get by with believing that the entirety of Israel's history, the entirety of the Torah and the Nevi'im, the law and the prophets, are coming to completion in Jesus the way all of technology and typewriters and electric typewriters and IBM Selectric typewriters and PCs come to completion in an Apple? So you're not Apple people, I suspect. What kind of person thinks all of history comes to completion in them? What sort of person who, when asked, are you the one who is to come? And this is found in Matthew 11. John the Baptist staring at his feet in a hole in prison on the far side of the Jordan River, wants to know if Jesus is the one who is to come or not. And he quotes a text, perhaps from Malachi, but probably just alluding to the fact, are you the Messiah? And when you're asked if you're the Messiah, you can either answer the question or not answer the question. But Jesus instead sabotages the question and turns it into another question. He says the lame can walk, the deaf can hear, the poor are being evangelized. Blessed is he who is not scandalized by me. He quotes and calls together three texts from Isaiah 29, Isaiah 35, and Isaiah 61, and he says, it's about me. What sort of person says this sort of thing? I think this question, who is Jesus, is a pressing question that you and I have to have the courage to ask. And we have to have the courage to ask people this question. People have all kinds of opinions about the church. They have all kinds of opinions about the Bible. They have all sorts of opinions about Christianity and priests and popes. But they also want to ask the question, who was Jesus? And I taught college students for 17 years. I taught an introduction to the Bible class almost every semester. 50% of my students were not Christians. But when they got to ask the question, who was Jesus, they got really interested. They weren't interested in Moses. In fact, I had one student come to me who shows sort of the system of education in our world. And he said, after the third class period, you keep talking about a guy named Moses. Who is Moses? He had never heard of Moses in his life. So he didn't know that, but he got really interested in questions about Jesus, and he studied all about Jesus. I think we need to create conversations in our communities where people are asking the question, who is Jesus? And we have midwife relationships with them. We want to lead them to the Gospels and say, you read about Jesus. You tell me who you think he is. And when you find people who are interested in this question, you don't have to give answers. All you have to do is point them to scriptures and get them to read Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. Any of them will do. And people suddenly have interesting opinions about Jesus that can generate conversations. And I saw this happen time and time and time again. One day, before classes began at North Park University, when I was still teaching college students, a student came to my office during registration week, and she said, I cannot take your introduction to the Bible class. I want permission to be exempted from taking this course because it's against my religion. I'm Hindu. And my wife's a psychologist, as David said. So I said to her, do I hear you asking? And so I tried to pretend like I was sympathetic. I'm a professor. And I said, you can't get out of this class. It's required. So she ramped it up. She said, my parents say I can't take this class. And I thought, well, we're not going to get very far with this. So I said, the president of our school says you have to take this course. Then she said, my religious priest tells me I can't take this course because it's against my religion. And I said, I didn't know exactly where to go with this. I thought I could go to the Pope or something like that, but it wouldn't have worked. So I just said, you know, it's required at this school because to be an American citizen, we believe you have to be familiar with the biblical tradition. You got to know something about the Bible. It's a part of our heritage. She said, well, I'm not taking the course. And she stormed, threw her stuff together, stormed out the door, and I looked out the door as she left, and she walked into the office of my colleague. And I'm Snoopy. So I walked over the door and I stuck my ear out the door. I just wanted to hear what she said to my colleague, whose name was Victoria. And I heard this statement come out of her mouth. Dr. McKnight just gave me permission to be dropped from introduction to the Bible because it's against my religion. And my colleague said, and I quote her, no, he didn't, honey, he can't. So this Hindu student came to introduction to the Bible class when she realized she had to come. She sat on the side of the class with her arms folded for 2 weeks. And then after 2 weeks, she dropped her arms and she was sort of looking at me every now and then. And after two more weeks, she started taking notes. And then about the 10th week, she came to me and she said, I'd like to take your course on Jesus of Nazareth. I find him really interesting. You know, this is what we have to offer. As Christians, we don't offer ourselves, we don't offer our church, our music, as good as it may be. All we do is offer Jesus to people in our world. And the best thing we can get people to do is for them to want to answer the question, who was Jesus? So I'd like you to consider today some of the sorts of questions and pushings that you can work with in your culture, in incidental ways. I don't think you should stand on street corners and say, who, with a big placard, who was Jesus? I don't think that's the way to do it. But you can get people to answer this question and say, you know, I'd like to read some of the Gospels with you. Would you be interested? And you don't have to have answers. Jesus is the answer. He will push himself on anybody who reads the Gospels. These texts will show you who he is. So I'd like you to consider not only some of his statements, but I'd like you to consider his radical practice at table. Consider his radical practice at table and what this says about who he is. Here's a text from Mark chapter 2. Once again, Jesus went out beside the lake. This is Galilee, a beautiful lake in the north part of the Holy Land. A large crowd came to him, and he began to teach them. As he walked along the seashore, he saw Levi, son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax collector's booth. This probably was a toll booth collecting taxes for entry into the land. So it had been people on the road who would have to pay taxes. We have these sorts of toll booths in Illinois. I'd love for Jesus to go ahead of me because the toll booth guy left after that, and maybe you could go free, but now we have these bars, and it's not so simple. Follow me, Jesus told Levi, and Levi got up and followed him. While Jesus was having dinner at Levi's house, the Pharisees sort of had a policy at the time of Jesus: if you're pure, you can eat with me. Jesus said, eat with me, I will make you pure. And there is the difference of all the world between Jesus and his Pharisaic opponents. They expected holiness that deserved their company, and Jesus said, my company will give you holiness. So he eats with tax collectors and sinners. And there were many tax collectors and sinners eating with him and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. And when the teachers of the Torah, experts in Scripture, who were Pharisees, saw Jesus eating with sinners and tax collectors, they asked Jesus' disciples, notice this, they didn't ask Jesus directly. One of the things you learn in reading the Gospels is don't ask Jesus any questions. He will deconstruct your question. So they asked the disciples, why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners? It's so contra convention. On hearing this, Jesus was a snoop as well. Jesus said to them, it is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners. Jesus had a practice of being able to welcome people who otherwise were unwelcome to his table. I cannot imagine what dinner was like with Jesus. You prepare for 4 and 30 show up. Because throughout the day he's been saying, we're going to be eating at Peter's house tonight, right by the sea. There are a lot of fish. Don't worry, we'll have plenty of food. Tilapia is the fish of choice in the Sea of Galilee. In the Holy Land, they call it St. Peter's fish. That's pretty cool, isn't it? So, Jesus invites all these people who are otherwise uninvited, and he brings them to the table, and they find a new society at this table that they've never experienced in their life. They have never been welcomed. They've never been a part of the in-group, and suddenly Jesus brings them to the table, and there are conversations had. They get to talk with people they'd never talked to. People talk to them whom they had never had conversations with. And all of a sudden, there was a new society being formed, a kingdom sort of society. And I can tell you that this is difficult for all of us. Apart from Green Bay Packer fans, we should be very welcoming. But it is extraordinarily difficult to invite people we don't like to have coffee or lunch. It's particularly vulnerable. We're going to have to face them. and talk to them, and it's going to be hard, and I don't want to do it. And that's what Jesus wants us to do. I learned about this one day sitting in my back porch. I was reading a book, and it was boring. And I looked up, and David mentioned that I'm a bird watcher. I looked up, and I noticed in the bush on the side of my yard a blue bird. Well, I'm pretty good at immediate recognition of birds in the Midwest. And at first I thought, well, maybe this is an indigo bunting. Now, that's a cool bird. But the blue was too soft and bright for an indigo bunting. And then I thought, well, maybe it's a blue jay. That's a closer color. But I noticed the shape of the bird behind the leaves, that it wasn't big enough to be a blue jay. Then I had a moment's thought that maybe it was a stray mountain bluebird from Colorado in Illinois. And then I thought, that's a bad idea. It's probably not. So I leaned forward, and as I leaned forward in my chair, the bird hopped out of the bush onto our fence, and it was my neighbor's blue parakeet. Well, this is a real letdown because I keep a life list. And this is not something you don't write in the back of your bird book, I saw a blue parakeet. You don't tell anyone about this, but here I am telling you as an embarrassment. So I told you the book was boring, so I watched the blue parakeet a while. And here's what happened. I kid you not. I grew up Baptist, and you can tell any story you want in a sermon if you're Baptist, but this is a true one. So, is that all right, David? The bird was on the fence row like this. And suddenly, on this side, there were about 30 sparrows who gathered to look at the blue parakeet. And there was a bit of a shorter part on the fence over here, and there were about 5 or 10 over here. And they were all looking at the blue parakeet. Like, this is weird. What do you do with a blue parakeet? And the blue parakeet did this. And all the sparrows flew away. They thought it was a terrorist or something, and it was going to attack them. And it was a bit embarrassing because we're Christians, and we put out Christian bird seed. This is the part I'm making up. And I'm thinking that the birds ought to be a little bit more Christianized by now and welcoming of a stranger. And they're not. And there are sparrows. So after a couple minutes, all the sparrows came back, and we're looking at the blue parakeet. And then the blue parakeet made a sound like this. And they all flew away again. So I went inside and I got on a Franciscan gown. And this is the part I'm making up too. And I came out and I preached to the birds about peace and being welcoming to your neighbor. Well, as I watched over 30 minutes, my backyard was transformed into a sacrament of welcome. It took a while for the sparrows to recognize that the blue parakeet was just a bird like them. But after a while, they decided it wasn't going to hurt them. And wherever the blue parakeet went, all the sparrows followed. So the blue parakeet flew onto my neighbor's garage and landed right in the middle of the side. Instead of on the top, on an edge, it just landed in the middle. It didn't know how to behave in the public. And all the sparrows surrounded it. 30 or 40 sparrows all around the blue parakeet, just kind of looking at it. You're a weirdo, but you're cool looking. And then the blue parakeet flew. Now, a parakeet can fly. Sparrows can barely. They just have a boring flight pattern. But the parakeet could dip and dive, and they would fly after it, but they couldn't keep up with it. Then it would come back. And then the sparrows all began, they got tired of this, and they had to eat, and they came to my bird feeder. And they are the silly birds that knock off all the bird seed to the ground for the squirrels to gather. And then they climb up my pole, and it's a struggle. But I win this struggle. I throw things at the squirrels. But the parakeet then began to feed. So the sparrows showed the way to feed. And over the next month, the sparrows and the blue parakeet got along. Now, I want to use this as a parable. Who are the blue parakeets in your neighborhood? Who are you afraid to invite to the table? Or who, when they show up on your fence row, do you fly away? Who scares you with their social presence? This is the sort of Jesus we had who attracted blue parakeets, and he gave them a voice in the neighborhood. He gave them the freedom to sing the way they can sing because he welcomed all people to the table. Jesus was this sort of person, is that he welcomed the blue parakeets. I had a student one time. College students can be crazy, but I love their craziness. But this student one time decided he wanted to understand homelessness in the United States. So he went home for a summer, for the month of June, and he came back to Chicago with $2 in his pocket. And he parked his car on the south side of Chicago, and he became homeless for a month to experience homelessness in Chicago. And I said, Drew, did your parents know what you were doing? He said, yeah, and they told me not to, but I had to do this. And he lived to tell about it, and he did a movie about it. And then he wanted to promote what people can do about homelessness in this world. So he traveled after he graduated on a bicycle from Seattle to San Diego. And what he decided to do was that he would sleep every night on the doorstep of a church. And I cannot tell you the stories of misery that he experienced at the hands of church people and pastors because he tried to sleep on their doorstep. They thought he was homeless, and he was doing nothing but trying to exhibit to people that churches need to welcome blue parakeets in their neighborhood. And he lived to tell about it. And he's an interesting guy, and he's always up to something like this, so I can't wait to see what he's going to do next. He's now living on a farm in Ohio. He's creating his own kind of farming community. But we need to be people who, like Jesus, when he saw a tax collector and a sinner — sinner is a nice Jewish word for someone who lives against the law, and probably females who are prostitutes — when he saw hookers and prostitutes in the land, he saw in them what God designed them to be. He saw a blue parakeet that can sing, and he wanted to make them sing. Do we see people like this? That's what Jesus sees. I want you to consider what Jesus is like when you look at how he practiced table fellowship with people who were otherwise rejected. I'd like you to consider also Jesus' orientation in ethics. People outside the church have all kinds of opinions on what Christians think is important, because they hear it from us. They hear from us that we don't like homosexuals, that we're supporting war, that we support torture. That's what many people hear about what Christians believe. And I think Jesus would weep at the reputation of Christians in our world today, at what they're known for and what they're known about. A scribe comes to Jesus in a world that debated law and how best to teach the Torah. A scribe comes to Jesus and he wants to know Jesus' opinion. In Jesus' world, it was known that there are 613 commandments and prohibitions in the Torah, which is our Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament. 365 prohibitions and 258 commandments. 613 of them. On top of that, there was an approach. There was an approach to figure out how best to live the Torah. Do you reduce the Torah or do you expand the Torah? The Pharisees expanded the Torah with rulings and regulations. They called it halakot, rulings of how to walk. And so there's a commandment in the Torah that says you are to follow Shabbat. You are not to work on Sabbath. Well, this raises a question. What is work? Is it work to watch the Chicago Cubs on Sunday afternoon? No, it's miserable. That's not work. So by the time of Jesus, they had developed about 40 rules, 40 regulations, 40 rulings on what constituted work. So a scribe comes to Jesus and he says, in Snow White fashion, of all the commandments, which is the fairest of them all? He wants Jesus to reduce the Torah. He doesn't want Jesus to expand the Torah. It's been obvious that Jesus is not an expander of the law. He's a reducer. So he wants to know what is the essence of the Torah. And Jesus says to the scribe, Shema Israel Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad Haftaed Adonai Eloheka B'kol Levavka U'b'kol Nafshecha U'b'kol Mo'adecha. Which being interpreted is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Here's a good Hebrew word to learn. Echad, one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And then Jesus says, and the second is this. And the scribe says, I didn't ask you for two, I asked you for one. Jesus said, don't interrupt me. I'm making this part up. And Jesus says, the second is this. Love your neighbor as yourself. Now he collects a text from your favorite book in the Bible and mine, Leviticus. And he grabs that text from Leviticus and he combines it to Israel's most famous creed called Shema. And he combines the two and he says the essence of life is to love God and to love others. Which is such a beautiful idea. As C.S. Lewis once said, or I copy C.S. Lewis, love is such a great idea until you have my neighbor. It's such a great idea until you see the person you have to love. And that's precisely why Jesus said this. Because there were many people who loved God, but they didn't love others. And if you love God and you don't love the people God made, you don't really love God. So Jesus said you must love God and love others. And he tells the parable of the Good Samaritan to illustrate this, where there's a priest and a Levite who love God and who know the Torah inside and out, and they see a dead body on the ground, or what they thought was a dead body, and they walk around it because they know the Torah. In the book of Leviticus and the book of Numbers, it says that a priest is never to defile himself with corpse impurity unless it's of someone of the nearest of kin. So by loving God, they choose not to love the body on the ground, and then they bring in a Green Bay Packer fan or a Good Samaritan, same thing, Yankee fan, maybe for you. And this person cares for the dead body, for the person who's not dead. And Jesus said, which of these people do you think did the will of God? The one who loved God or the one who loved the person? The person on the ground who was loved by the Samaritan is the one who loved God and loved others. Jesus calls you and me to love others. And the combination of Hear, O Israel, with love your neighbor as yourself, I call this the Jesus Creed. That it shows up all the time in Jesus' teachings. And about 10 years ago, when I was teaching college students, they were all wearing WWJD bracelets. And I jokingly said to one of my students, I don't know sometimes what Jesus would do, but I know one thing he did do. Every morning and every evening, he recited Shema in the Jesus Creed form. So let's start practicing this together. So I began to say the Jesus Creed in the morning when my feet hit the ground, and in the evening when I took my feet off the ground, and I made a promise to myself that I would say it every time it came to mind. The Jesus Creed, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. And the second is this, love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. And I began to say this over and over whatever it came to mind. I said it in Hebrew because it made me feel smart. But I noticed that it worked its way into my bones. And it made me sensitive to people I had never been sensitive to. And it made my moral life very uncomfortable that I was a nice Christian professor who didn't love others. And I learned from reciting this to respond to people I had never noticed in my life. And in the semester that I began to teach it, I had a student from New Hampshire. Pretty clever student. Probably the smartest student I ever had at North Park University. And he was the first student I ever taught who brought a computer to class. And he sat in the back row and typed very lightly. His name was Tim. And he came to me in the first semester and he said, "I want to tell you something that's happened to me." He said, "I've started saying the Jesus Creed every morning when I get up and every evening when I go to bed." And he said, "I've been walking to school for 2 years by homeless people and I never noticed them. And now I know their names. And we had a party at my house the other night for the homeless people." And then he said, he came to me in April of his senior year, 2 years later. Well, I should tell you that because of, I'll back up. Because of Tim's sensitivity to the homeless people, he got students. This is what college students do who are leaders. They got students involved with the homeless people in the neighborhood of Chicago. And it became so big, it began to spread around universities in the United States. And Tim became so big that he was invited to the G8 conference in England to talk about what college students are doing for the homeless people. All because he said the Jesus Creed, so be careful. In April of his senior year, Tim came to me and he said, "I have two opportunities. I need your advice. I never believe it when a college student wants advice. I think they often just want confirmation of what they think I should give them as advice." But Tim came to me and he said, "I have two opportunities. I can work with the homeless in Chicago with a major organization that works with the homeless, or I can begin to work on a PhD at Duke University with Stanley Hauerwas. I quoted Jesus, 'The poor you will always have with you. Go to Duke.'" Two weeks later, he graduated. As he walked through the line, he said to me, "I'm going to work with the homeless. I'll go to Duke later." I said, "Go to Duke." Every year, Tim came by the campus to tell me about the homeless people in the United States and the homeless people in Chicago and what's going on. Then Jim Wallace grabbed him, and he's now working at Sojourners Community. He's the main leader at Sojourners Community in Washington, D.C., working for advocacy of social justice. And Tim will tell you, he's a New Hampshire guy. It's all because he said the Jesus Creed in the morning. He became sensitive to blue parakeets in his world. Consider the orientation that Jesus has to ethics when we ask the question, who was Jesus? Another thing that I think we can consider is this when we ask the question, who was Jesus? Consider his style of teaching. And the most dramatic, noticeable feature of Jesus' teachings is that he told stories like a Southern Baptist preacher. He told parables. And you know what stories do to you. They usher you into a reality. There was a hole in the ground where a hobbit lived. And now we go to Middle Earth. And all of a sudden, there's all kinds of people in this room right now who are thinking about Middle Earth because of a hole in the ground that J.R. Tolkien wrote on the back of some student's examination paper because he found the sentence. Because of a story. I think of C.S. Lewis and the wardrobe door. How many times have you been through the wardrobe door? Into Narnia. It's a place we go because of a story. And I love Flannery O'Connor, a Southern writer, short story writer. And she writes some of the most grotesque stories imaginable, filled with grace of God toward blue parakeets in her world. And she told a brilliant story called Parker's Back of the conversion of a man, and his way of expressing his conversion is he got a huge tattoo of Jesus that covered his back. And his wife, who was a Christian named Sarah Ruth, pounded it full of blood with a broom because she rejected what her husband had done. That's the sort of thing that Flannery O'Connor will do to you. Grotesque. Weird. Jesus tells stories, and when he tells these stories, he initiates us to imagine a different kind of world. It's exactly what he does. He tells these stories so that we will enter into them and lose our peripheral vision, and we will see the world that Jesus has created. And as a result of that created story, Jesus will push us back out of the wardrobe door, and we'll find ourselves in our uncle's place, and we're back to reality, and now we've been transformed. And now we learn to live out the reality that Jesus calls us to. In Matthew chapter 13, Jesus tells this story. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. Now that's not very glorious, which is just the point. Which a man took and planted in his field. Though it is the smallest of all seeds, yet when it grows, it is the largest of garden plants and becomes a tree so that blue parakeets can come and perch it in its branches. He's quoting actually probably from Isaiah, and it could be talking about Gentiles who were the blue parakeets of Jesus' world. He wants us to see that the kingdom of God is not about the flash and the boom of the Roman Empire with big horses and cavalry and all the bling bling that comes connected to the emperor. It's about little people doing little things in ordinary lives with ordinary people that make the little very large. It's when you take a cup of cold water and give it to the person who's thirsty. It's when you send an email note to the person who's sick, who learns that you care about them, you know their name, and you love them. Jesus wants us to understand that the little is large, and he turns the Roman Empire upside down, sabotages it, subverts it with the gospel of grace, the gospel of a mustard seed. And that's what Jesus calls us to do. And then the next parable, the kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed into 60 pounds of flour until it worked all through the dough. You know, yeast is normally an image of evil in the Jewish world. Jesus turns it inside out, and he sees in yeast the potential of permeating, though you can barely see its presence. We don't have to be noticeable. We don't have to have neon lights. We don't have to have big billboards. It is the ordinary actions of loving Christian people that are transformative in our society, and those are the things that Jesus calls us to do and to be, because he tells us a story into which we enter, and that story gives us a new vision for reality. I'd also like you to consider Jesus' demanding call to follow him. Everybody likes to talk about the Sermon on the Mount until they read it. And when they read it, they realize how challenging it is. And there's a history of Christian interpretation that basically does everything it can so that we don't have to follow it. Is that none of these things really have to be followed. He's trying to show us that we're sinners and we can trust in him. Only that's not the way Jesus finishes the sermon. But if you read the Gospel of Matthew, you can read in Matthew 4:23, Jesus came into the villages and he was teaching the kingdom of God in their synagogues. He was preaching the gospel of the kingdom and he was healing all sicknesses and diseases. And that same expression is found in Matthew chapter 9:35, that Jesus was preaching the kingdom of God, teaching in their synagogues and healing all sicknesses and diseases. And this is a literary device that begins a section and ends a section so that you can see that Jesus' ministry is made up of three things. He preaches, he teaches, and he heals. Chapters 8 and 9 is all the healing of Jesus. Chapters 5, 6, and 7, the Sermon on the Mount, is the illustration of the preaching and teaching of Jesus. And what Matthew is doing is saying, here's Jesus, take him or leave him. And the teachings of Jesus are found in Matthew 5 through 7. He calls his disciples. He stands on a mountain. Matthew is describing this as if Jesus is the new Moses. And he gives the Beatitudes to describe the sorts of people who are in the kingdom of God that is against all wisdom of the day. Not the powerful, not the righteous, not the pious. It's the poor, it's the mourning, it's the hungry, it's the peacemakers. They are made up of the kingdom. And then Jesus calls us to be salt and light. Then he gives six illustrations that you have heard that this is the way it is, but this is what I have to say. And he calls Jesus, his followers, to listen to his teachings and follow these teachings. Then he gives three illustrations of church discipline or spiritual disciplines of almsgiving or giving money, prayer, and fasting. And he turns those inside out and teaches how his followers are to practice spiritual disciplines. And then he calls his disciples to single-minded devotion. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. And then chapter 7 is a collection of teachings from a variety of angles, climaxing in the golden rule, do not do to others what you don't want done to you. And then Jesus tells a little story, a parable. And it's one that I sang as a child in Sunday school class with a flannel graph. The wise man, the foolish man built his house on sand, and the wise man built his house on rock. And then when we sang the song, we all fell down. And we laughed and had fun, as kids can only have fun with a deadly serious parable that is actually about hell. It's a powerful image. At the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says it's not people who say, who confess, Lord, Lord, the people who do what I say. And so the parable is told at the end of the story so that we can be ushered into a world where we see that Jesus is calling us to follow what he wants. And I can tell you that nothing is more powerful and penetrating for the postmodern generation than these radical words of Jesus when he says, I want you to follow me. And my students loved Shane Claiborne. He lives in Philadelphia in a poor neighborhood, and he dresses weird, real weird. He makes his own clothes, and I've told Shane, you got to get a better gig. That outfit's awful. And he says, I want to symbolize poverty like St. Francis in our world. And more people are saying, I want to see people who really live it out, and I want to follow Jesus. So we need to encourage people to go to the gospel and listen to Jesus teach. And then we need to say, follow that. Go for it. Give your life to Jesus. It'll be demanding. It won't be fun. Some days it's going to be awful. But that's the call of Jesus, to follow him, to give your life to him. I want you to consider today this kind of Jesus. The sort of Jesus who enters on Palm Sunday and mocks Rome. Little Galilean, mocking mighty Rome. He doesn't care if they don't like him. The Jesus who called people to follow him. The Jesus who practiced table fellowship with blue parakeets. The Jesus who practiced table fellowship with blue parakeets because he really did believe that the essence of the will of God was to love God and to love others. That this is the Jesus who calls us to follow him. And I would exhort you to be the sort of people who ask people that question, who was this guy? Are you willing to give your life to this person who said these sorts of things in that world?